Good morning.
Good morning.
So, can we talk about white supremacy? This is, I'm going to go with yes. Okay? And I want to start by admitting that I am expecting that I will fail this morning. Not for lack of trying, but because the task in front of us is so big, so old, so complicated, and so emotionally fraught. My wish is that we could talk this morning in a way that gets us straight to the work of joyful action, moving our world in the direction of holding more justice and freedom for everyone, without making detours through the minefields of shame, guilt, fear, anger, grief. And I kind of don't think that's possible. It's likely that some or many of you will feel one or more of those emotions as we go through the morning. If you don't, that's okay. You should know in getting ready for the sermon, I went through a lot of them. I over-prepared, I read so much, I sweated last night going to sleep, whether I'd gotten anything good down on paper. I got up this morning thinking, oh, but I forgot to say, and I forgot to put in, and it's all right. We are not called to do anything perfectly. We're called to try to do our best. So I am proud of all of us for showing up this morning. We are, this morning, one of over 680 Unitarian Universalist congregations who are participating either this Sunday or last Sunday. Some are going to participate a little bit later in what is being called the UU White Supremacy Teach-In. I want to just note, this is not true. I had to go look up what is a teach-in exactly, because I'm actually just a little too young. Usually now I could say, oh, if you're as old as me, you might remember. But I'm a little too young to remember teach-ins. Teach-ins traditionally is a time like we decide we're going to talk about this, and we just sit here, and we talk, and we ask questions, and we help each other understand answers, and we just talk forever and ever and ever and ever. Well, we're not exactly doing this. I'm going to talk now. If you want to do a little more of the teach-in kind of thing, that'll be in the talk back afterwards. But we are doing this because we were asked by UUs of color significantly and by the UU leadership to consider doing this. We were asked, your board discussed it. I said, hey, I'm willing to do this. The board talked about it and said, yes, we can do this. And your name is on the website for the teach-in. You are officially a participating congregation, and I'm really proud of you for doing that. In case you have no or little idea of what I'm talking about, I'm going to refer you to the recent UU World summaries online, and they'll be coming out in print, I'm sure, soon. They're good summaries in the UU World of what the news from our Unitarian Universalist Association of Congregations over the last month and a half, 2 months. There's been a lot going on. We're not going to go through all of that right now. The super short version is that in response to a hiring decision made in the UUA's congregational life / regional staff and announced in March, a number of our UU siblings of color and their white allies have suggested or perhaps insisted that we need to attend to racial bias in hiring practices. That conversation has widened out to a call to consider the role of white supremacy in UU structures and culture generally. I'm going to read, I just came across this morning. It was on Facebook, posted yesterday by the person who curates Worship Web, which if you don't know is a wonderful collection of readings and words for worship and really great stuff. But this was posted yesterday. YR, and the number at the moment she posted this was 684, Unitarian Universalist congregations committing to hold a UU white supremacy teach-in. In the words of the UUA Leadership Council and Black Lives of UU, and I'm just going to quote the next three paragraphs, with humility and courage born of our history, we are called as Unitarian Universalists to build the beloved community where all souls are welcome as blessings and the human family lives whole and reconciled. With this vision in our hearts and minds, Unitarian Universalist congregations around the world have stopped business as usual and are responding to a call to action from a growing network led by UUs of color and white UUs working together to look critically within our faith communities, including hiring practices, power brokers, and cultural habits, for the ways racism, sexism, and white supremacy live. We believe that hundreds of UU churches signaling to their own members and to the larger community that our faith takes racism seriously, especially within our own walls, will push our faith toward the beloved community we all seek. Everyone involved in this teaching knows that the word supremacy can be a difficult one. Some have asked if we couldn't just stick with the language of white privilege, with which some of us are more or less familiar and comfortable. And we, here in this room, are going to talk about privilege some this morning. But here's why I think it's important for us to learn to work with the idea of supremacy as well. Privilege, and by that I mean not so much the thing privilege, but the label privilege, the word, the idea of privilege, is often experienced in our lives individually. Okay. It also has some lingering resonance with the idea of being something that is deserved, even though we all know, well, you probably know if you've been involved in any conversations about race, that when we talk about white privilege, part of the point is that it's not deserved. It just is. But the word privilege, we still use it when we're talking about discipline, for instance, or behavior, children's behavior especially. You know, there are privileges and responsibilities and punishments or consequences. So it's part of that language that we use. So it has some overtones when we use the word privilege of being something that is deserved. And it also feels to me, you may have a different understanding of privilege, but to me that word feels like it's talking about something that's kind of optional and maybe potentially under our control. That is, it can be granted and withheld, it can be accepted or waived, it can be noticed or, more commonly, not noticed, not acknowledged at all. The word supremacy, on the other hand, is a heavy word. It's a little more in your face. It indicates a reality that depends on the support of social structures. It's not just about individuals, what they choose or what they experience, but it's about the system. It applies to groups of people and the institutions which they build, support, and maintain. The word supremacy just feels wrong to us in a way that privilege does not, and I think that's helpful at this point. What the thing we are trying to name should not feel right to us. And that's part of the point of being asked to talk about it with that language. We are ashamed when we think about this idea of white supremacy because it implies that maybe we have some affiliation with these ideologies that run counter to our cherished values. We should feel a little uneasy. Also, supremacy in our culture it's compulsory. It's not optional like privilege. You can't sort of have it or not or walk away from it or decline that honor. Thank you very much. We're just in it. We are in it. We can't help but be affected by it no matter who we are, no matter the color of our skin. We are affected by it. We live in it, move in it, breathe in it, even if we're unconscious or ignorant of its workings. So this is why supremacy, it's a big word, it's a heavy word, and it's the word I want us to sit with today because it's big and heavy. I think we need practice in being able to use language that speaks clearly and even forcefully the truth about the world in which we live, the ocean in which we swim, the air that we breathe. Furthermore, we need practice in speaking truth and listening to truth, even if we haven't figured out the best language to use. I believe in truth. I do. I believe that truth will set us free. I don't believe I know how exactly to explain that happens, but I feel in my gut that that's true. And so it's important to try to talk about what is true about who we are and how we live and what supports our lives. I also think it is very, very, very human to avoid, to resist, to deny truth when it causes us discomfort or threatens the orderliness of our lives or threatens the power base through which we secure our lives and our livelihoods or think that we do. It might be uncomfortable, but I think we are strong enough to face the truth about our lives and our culture and even about our beloved spiritual institutions. But I want to be very, very clear that talking about white supremacy and recognizing that the UUA is affected by or infected by the culture of white supremacy is not the same thing as saying that the UUA is a white supremacist organization. Okay? Really, this, a lot of people, I think, have reacted with a great deal of hurt and fear because they think maybe the UUA is admitting to be a white, to being a white supremacist organization, and we are not. White supremacists believe that whites are superior. If you look at our principles, at who we say we are, at the ways we engage the world around us and try to build justice in the world, clearly we don't believe that. We don't aspire to promote that as a value. We are not a white supremacist organization. White supremacy, on the other hand, is a social and cultural system based on the assumption of white superiority that was made a long time ago. And that assumption has become so ingrained in the structures of everyday life that personal understanding or assent to these assumptions is unnecessary. So I hope this makes sense. If it doesn't, we can talk about it more. And this makes me wonder, could it be that part of our legacy as a largely white, historically and economically privileged tradition is a tendency to feel more comfortable with folks like us? And does that tendency lead us to be less welcoming, less diverse, and frankly, less just than our ideals point us to be? I am, frankly, uncomfortable passing judgment on the hiring practices of the UUA because I am neither sufficiently familiar with them nor, and perhaps you will find fault with me for this, nor am I willing to make myself familiar with them to the extent that I feel I would need to make responsible judgment on whether what so-and-so did or so-and-so's response, whether those were right or wrong to do. I'm going to leave that. But I am also unwilling to simply dismiss the testimonies of our siblings of color in the UUA. And what has happened is that there was this hiring decision and somebody said, but wait. And when this one person said, but wait, let me tell you what my experience has been here, other people lined up to say, me too, me too, me too, me too. This often happens when somebody breaks silence and dares to say something, other people, and the evidence piles up. So there are lots of our people, our UU siblings, who are saying, I am being hurt by this institution in these ways, and I think it is because I am a person of color. And I think it is important for us to listen to them. I think that was the point of the white supremacy teach-in, and this is why we're here this morning. Perhaps, well, part of why I think it's important too, and I'll say a little bit more about this later, much of what's been unfolding over these last few years fits with what I know personally about how oppression works. I'm not an expert in race, but I am a little bit of an expert on gender and patriarchy and clergy sexual professional misconduct from because of the personal relationships I've had, the experiences I've had, what I'm seeing bubbling up in our organization fits a lot of those same patterns, which lends some credibility to me in what people are saying. So let me just outline. These are frankly, I couldn't figure out a way to round everything up and say it in a way that I like. So this is a little bit random. This is what I know about how supremacy, white supremacy, works. And I'm gonna kind of flip back and forth. White supremacy, I take to be subset's the wrong word because it implies it's less than, but it's a kind of supremacy. I think we live not just in a culture of white supremacy, but a culture of supremacy. We have this idea that reality is about being over or being under, winning or losing. And it's not the same thing as hierarchy at all, actually. It overlaps with hierarchy in really troubling ways, but that's not it. Supremacy is systemic. It has many layers. It is in the ways we interact and the institutions we build and the habits we have of deciding how we will do things, who we will talk to, who we'll let in which rooms, which clubs, sit at which tables. There's lots of layers. It's very complex, and it is intersectional, by which I mean it's about race, but it's also about gender. It's about sexuality. It's about orientations of all sorts. It's about how well your body works compares to how well or how the way my body works, or it's about all sorts of things. Think of all the different ways people can find to make judgments about each other. It's about all of those. It's not just racial. Supremacy is systemic in the sense that it is self-perpetuating. It has to start somewhere. It sort of gathered, I think, as best I can tell, as a story, and something happens. It kind of starts, it builds, it gathers, and becomes this big systemic thing. It does start with an ideology. You know, that we are going to act as if white people are better than black people because it suits our economic interests, for instance. You see this in colonial America. But it picks up steam and it solidifies in the institutions and the documents we write and the structures we build for decision making so that it just goes on its merry way. It doesn't actually rely on you and I actually thinking that way, holding that assumption any longer. And so it's not personal. If we talk about Unitarian Universalism, participating in white supremacy, it doesn't mean we're saying each of us individually is guilty of assuming that white people are superior. It just doesn't. It doesn't mean we're not responsible. This is tricky. But it's not personal. And yet, it feels personal, especially in the effects that it has on us, both on the upside and the downside of any relationship of supremacy. I am kind of intrigued by, and do I have it with me? No, I'm going to skip that point. It's interesting, but I was going to take you to Elizabeth Schussler Fiorenza, who 25 years ago, came up with the concept of curiarchy, which I've just learned from friends who are in school now is a word that's coming back. It's being used again, but it really effectively means the same thing as it's from the Greek, means the same thing as what I'm describing as supremacy.
What's
it's kind of kyriarchy. It's kyriarchy. It's from the Greek, but it's sort of like kyrie eleison. It's Lord. It's the word for Lord. So it's sort of a lordship. It's like the rule of lordship. It's this idea that the way the world is ordered is that somebody's got to be on top. So anyway, I said I wouldn't take you there, and I did. So here's what else I know about white supremacy. Oppression is costly. It costs different on the upside and the downside, but it costs everybody. It consumes the bodies and the lives, literally the lives, of those who are oppressed. But it deforms the humanity of the oppressors and the privileged. It causes them to lie about the truth. The truth is not that some of us are superior to others. It just isn't. But we act as if that is the truth. We live as if we're willing to accept somebody else's assumption that that is the truth. It limits everyone's choices. And those limits are different. There is no doubt that if you're on the downside, you are more limited. But even the people on the upside are limited. You know, you can get labeled a race traitor, for instance, and people can bring real force to bear on having you step back in line where you should be. Another thing that I like, that I have found really useful, and I can't remember where I heard it first, you've probably heard it too, but privilege is what you don't have to think about. And we talk about white privilege a lot, and whites are often unaware of the realities of Black lives and culture. We're unaware that we are privileged. And this is, sometimes it's a chosen ignorance. We just would rather not know. That's unpleasant. We don't happen to know any Black people. We don't live anywhere near them. We don't run into them. We don't need to know. And sometimes it's an ignorance that we know we don't know, but we just would just rather not. And we maybe don't know, and there is no reason in our lives that we need to know. Our survival does not depend on understanding Black culture as white people. If we are white people, this is in the same way that they know our culture, they understand it really well. Because if they misstep when they're in an engagement with white culture, they can get dead for that. in ways that white people and their, I'm the mother of a 17-year-old son, and it just, when I think about it, I don't worry as much that he'll come home safely when he takes the car out of the driveway as I know other mothers worry. And there is nothing fair about that. Another thing I know, and this is, I know because I'm a Unitarian Universalist, or maybe I'm a Unitarian Universalist because I know this, but we are all connected. Really, really, truly. It's been said a lot, but none of us are free unless we are all free. We need each other, and I'm gonna follow UU white anti-racist activist Chris Crass in suggesting that the only goal really worth having is one of collective liberation. Liberation for all of us. We are all not as free as we might be. And this collective liberation would be something new on the face of the earth. This is not about us being particularly bad human beings. This is just tricky. It has always been tricky. Chris Crass, in one of his books, quotes Anne Braden, who he introduces as a longtime white Southern anti-racist organizer. And she says, "I believe this is the genius of humankind, the thing that makes us half divine, the fact that some human beings can envision a world that has never existed." We are envisioning something that has never existed. And she goes on after that. She says, "Perhaps no one living today will see a major change, but it will come. And living in that world that is working to make it happen lets us know that our lives are worthwhile." And, as I've said before, I also know that racism is not the only problematic form of supremacy in our world. It's not the only one worthy of our attention. But as Americans, at least right this moment in our history, it is of special concern. And it's very much come to the forefront of our attention lately. I'd like to suggest that this is not so much a crisis in the sense of a bad thing that needs to be fixed, although it is that, but I think it's even more an opportunity. It's an invitation to nudge our collective well-being more in the direction of our values and hopes. So this is what I know right now about supremacy, and how do I know those things? Well, mostly I know them from reading and listening and thinking and talking. As I indicated before, I also know some of it from direct experience, my own or people I'm in close relationship to. But here I want to share a couple of personal experiences in which I learned to notice the white privilege that I enjoy. The first time, it's basically the same experience happened twice, you know, with different people. And the first time was 30 years ago. I was in my 20s, and I was a graduate student living alone in Nashville. With my family was in eastern Pennsylvania, so I spent some time driving back and forth up Highway 81. I did that trip a couple times, at least a year. And one day, I'm in Nashville talking to one of my friends, very much like me, about the same age, also in a PhD program at Vanderbilt, smart young woman. Looked together, actually, I think she always looked way more together than I ever felt anyway. She was somebody I respected, trusted. She's very intelligent. And we were talking about traveling. I think her family lived in the Northeast somewhere too. And I said, oh, sometimes I can do it all in one day if it's summertime and the daylight's long. But usually I stop somewhere. I just get a hotel room. Even though I'm alone, I get a hotel room because there's some, you know, major chains right off the interstate around Roanoke, Virginia. And she said, oh, I would never do that. I wouldn't be safe. She's African American. And I went, oh. Now, I told my husband this story last night, and he insists she would have been safe even 30 years ago. He says he believes that she didn't feel safe. And I was like, so you think, you don't trust her? I mean, she's really smart. So I don't know, but that was the first time that I realized that I move around the world with significantly less fear. Now, I was afraid a little bit, not a lot. Obviously, I wouldn't have done it. I was a little afraid being a woman alone on the interstate. But mostly, I move around the world knowing that if I get into trouble, there are more often than not, people I encounter will want to help me rather than exploit me or take advantage of my being in trouble. I just know this. And what I heard my friend say was that she doesn't live with that luxury. She doesn't have that privilege. So then we move on with life. Lots of life happens, and about 25 years later, I'm back at the Divinity School getting a Master's of Divinity. It's about 5 years ago now. I'm talking with two of my classmates. They're both in their 20s, I think. Now I'm 25 years older. And I'm telling them about my favorite barbecue place. Oh, yeah, me and my family, we go out to Carl's Perfect Pig in White Bluff. Anybody of you ever been to Carl's Perfect Pig? There's no, I mean, I think it's some of the best barbecue I know. But it's this, you know, little Saturday jaunt we take sometimes. The booths are painted bright, bright pink. And they have pig things hung on the wall. And then we eat the pigs. But it's really good. And it's, you know. So these are two of my colleagues, bright, sharp, young professionals in training. One's an accomplished musician. One is working in one of the dean's offices at Vanderbilt while doing his degree. And they're learning to be pastors. And they're, again, very smart, very sharp people. And they both say to me, I could never go there. I don't think I'd be safe. One is an African-American woman, and one is a gay man. And I am, again, kind of going, oh, I knew this, and I forgot. I forgot that I just get to go anywhere I want. Mostly, there are places I don't go because I'm a little afraid. But I pretty much go where I want. And there are lots and lots of places where I want to go that I don't even think twice about going, that people I love don't feel they can go to. I felt in that moment, and in the years since when I think about these moments, I feel that in those moments I deserve to be bopped upside the head, you know, a little bunny foo-foo kind of. And it's really notable to me that my friends didn't do that to me. They just said, oh, I can't do that. And they left me to process it. They weren't being heavy-handed. They were sharing the realities of their lives. And this, I think, is what we're being called to do right now. Nobody wants to bop us on the head. They just want us to pay attention. Folks who know me tend to characterize me with annoying regularity as someone who thinks too much. So for me, experiences like these of coming face to face with my ignorance of or my lack of thought about how much I do not notice have made me wonder what else I'm missing. Sometimes now I remember to stop and listen when others describe how it feels to live within their own lives. So when folks of color report discrimination, I don't feel I can discount those reports out of hand. When UUs of color, with whom I share a covenantal relationship informed by shared values, report that they are being hurt by our association, I feel responsible. Not guilty, but responsible in the sense of accountable. I want to understand what they are experiencing and why they are experiencing it, and I want to think about how we can all move toward more justice and more love. So here's some suggestions about what to do with that sense of responsibility if you, as I suspect you might, join me in feeling that way sometimes. First, Respond to reasonable requests, requests that you can actually commit to responding to, especially when those requests come from committed and covenanted partners and colleagues. So for instance, when our Unitarian Universalist siblings, the ones who use the same seven principles we use, when they call us, ask us, can you sit and think about this for one Sunday? Say yes when you can, like you have. Use the language that they say we need to try to use. Sometimes we don't, we are such wordsmiths, we are so good at this, and I really love that about us. Our seven principles have lasted for a good long time. We're in the process of rethinking some of them, rethinking the set a little bit, but they last a long time because we're wordsmiths. But we need to not let that get in the way of understanding what people are trying to get us to understand about what their lives feel like and about the truth of our own lives as well. We need to listen and we need to learn about Black experience and Black culture. There is so much reading you can do. Let me tell you, I did a lot of it while I was avoiding writing the sermon. I'll give you a list. If you want a list of places to go, I'll give it to you. I did just read Michael Eric Dyson's book, which was just published like, 10 days ago. I've been avoiding heavy duty, writing this all down. It's really good. It's really, you gotta breathe a lot reading it, but it is so loving. He says over and over again, he's talking to white people. The subtitle, I should give you the title, which I left on my chair. Tears We Cannot Stop, the subtitle is A Sermon to White America. But he addresses us directly, us white people. And he says, beloved, I know you're scared. He says, my friends, I know this is hard, but we need you to do this. We need you to think about this. We need you to hear us. It's a really good read. I learned a lot. He talks about racism in sports, and he talks about, he's got his own set of narratives about the traffic stops, and this is a big deal. People getting stopped because they're driving a car and they're not white. He's great. Ta-Nehisi Coates is great. There's lots of bloggers who are great. If you just go to Black Lives of UU has a website. If you go to that website and look for the white supremacy teach-in, you can get links to all kinds of really great blog posts. And so there's lots to read, to talk about, think about. There's so many resources. So explore them. If you don't like something, just close it and go to something else because there's lots of good stuff. We can learn to recognize and sit with, instead of evading or fixing or discounting, uncomfortable emotional reactions. And if you do that reading, if you do that talking, that listening, you will have those emotional reactions. You will feel uncomfortable. You will feel sad. You will be angry. You could be all sorts of things. So practice just feeling those things. We tend not to be so good with feelings. I know one of my lifelong challenges is learning to deal with my feelings. Another thing we can do with our sense of responsibility is to learn about our white culture. We have an amen? Okay. Our friends of color can describe white culture really well for us, and we might as well just go ahead and listen. There are beautiful descriptions. Am I out of time? Yeah, somebody's, oh yeah, I'll wrap it up. Anyway, there's beautiful descriptions of white supremacy culture. And then think about how you can inoculate yourself with some antidotes to those. There's also, some of those descriptions have, so if perfectionism is a problem, you can learn to like do things not perfectly, like this sermon. And then know, this is my last big point, with this responsibility, know that we do this work not just for other people. If you're white, we're not doing it just for these other people. We do this work for ourselves too. Remember the seventh principle? It's all connected. We are all connected. This is a moment in our history for important learnings and conversations and changes around race. But what we do to address white supremacy and how we do it matters in all our other efforts to build the world we dream of and grow ourselves into worthy citizens of the world. May we be so.